The Planning Task Force will come to order. Thank you, members of the task force, for being here. Our first item is just to approve the August 19th, 2015 meeting minutes. Representative Nelson, would you like to do that?
Sure, I'll move the minutes from the previous
meeting. Okay, Representative Nelson moves the meeting minutes, approval of the meeting minutes from August 19th, 2015. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevailed. Meeting minutes are approved. Welcome back, everyone. This has been a real run-and-gun task force in the sense that because of an accident of the calendar, or maybe just because they're the only dates that we can get agreement on, we have had three meetings in about 5 weeks. That pace will be different from now on. We will actually have kind of a pretty good interim before the next meeting, but we had one in very late July, one in August, and now one in very early September. So the pace will start to slow and regulate itself a little bit more. But thank you all for being here. We are short a few members at this task force, which is okay. That's just as it is, trying to get everyone to appear at once. I know that two of our four legislators are unable to be here, and then some others as well. But that said, before we get to the first presentation, I'm hoping that we can, again, though it's our third meeting, we're still familiarizing ourselves with one another, just go, starting with Ms. Olson, and just introduce ourselves to everyone for the record.
I'm Representative Michael Nelson from Brooklyn Park.
Manager Taylor Cox, Strategic Planning, Minnesota National Guard.
Lucinda Messman, representing Minnesota Association of Townships.
I'm Barrett Land, I'm the Emergency Management Director for the City of Minneapolis.
Gary Poser, Director of Elections for the Secretary of State's Office.
Steve Simon, Secretary of State.
Ann Kanaroth, Deputy of the Secretary of State's Office.
Grace Wachlerowitz, on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm from Minneapolis.
Senator Mary Kiffmeyer represents Senate District 30, which is the east part of Sherburne and Wright counties.
And I'm Julie Strother, a Government Relations Director with the Secretary of State's Office.
Okay. And thank you for those who are here today in the audience as well. I note that, Senator Sieben, good to have you here. We had thought you wouldn't be able to make it, so it's good to have her. We also have with us again Matt Gehring from House Research, and as before, as I may have mentioned to you, he's here to take in and receive any questions we might have, but not necessarily to answer them today. So thank you, Mr. Gehring, for being here as well. We're going to have a little bit of a switcheroo here. As you may have heard as you were filing in or sitting down, our planned number two on the agenda needs a little bit of extra time because of some traffic problems. So we're going to go with the third item on the agenda, which is Ms. Strother's presentation on review of state laws allowing special emergency procedures. Ms. Strother.
Mr. Chair. Before we do that, I just wanted to recognize that Task Force member Margo Indy Cross has also joined us.
There she is.
Yeah. So,
Ms. Cross, thank you. Thanks for being here. Thank you.
Closer to a microphone here. And in case it wasn't clear, I apologize. I put together the agenda, and the person who was supposed to be first on the agenda and is going to be coming after me is going to be calling in. So that will happen after this. At the last meeting, I gave a brief overview of the different approaches that different states take towards emergency planning. Those plans, though, were designed to sort of deal with the status quo of law and implement the election under the status quo. But today I'm going to give a quick overview of the different emergency specific laws that different states have. So I've lumped them into categories. The first is obviously the postponement of an election. The National Association of Secretaries of State gave a long overview of this in their presentation. But as you remember, it's a real gray area in state law, whether or not we can actually postpone a federal election. The next category is polling place changes and polling place consolidation. There's also changes in the method of election, special procedures for emergency first responders, and then there's some special procedures that apply to all voters, either with ballot replacement or emergency absentee voting procedures that wouldn't apply to just first responders, but all voters in the election. And finally, the last one is extension of polling place hours. So looking first at changes in polling place location and polling place consolidation. If you'll remember, Minnesota has a procedure for moving a polling place on election day, but it can only be moved within the precinct or within a mile of the precinct. So these states have additional procedures that go beyond that. The first, California, allows the relocation of a satellite polling location. They're required to give 48 hours notice if they're going to do that, but it can be moved anywhere within the county. Next, Florida. Florida obviously has lots of experience dealing with emergencies on or around Election Day. And Florida can move a polling place if there's an emergency within the precinct anywhere. There's no restriction on where, except it must be safe and convenient. So convenient would assume would be near the original location of the precinct, but there's no specific restriction on where that needs to be. Hawaii allows polling place consolidation. So this wouldn't necessarily be moving a polling place to a new location, but could also encompass taking many different polling places and combining them into one. So the only restriction they have on that is that it must be within the representative district. And so you can, you know, there's a limit on the number of polling places you can combine. And they do have a requirement that news broadcast the location of the new combined polling place. The next sort of category of changes is changes in the method of administering an election. So Hawaii has voting like we have where you vote in person on Election Day. They also have absentee voting. But if there's a natural disaster, the chief election official or county clerk may switch to vote by mail for the state. In that case, all registered voters would be delivered a ballot by mail, like we have vote by mail in different precincts in the state of Minnesota. And the state law does require that all registered voters be notified of that change. One would presume that this would be a natural disaster that doesn't occur on Election Day, but occurs in advance of Election Day, knowing that they wouldn't be able to operate the number of polling places that they would like. And then the next category is probably the most common category of emergency procedures, and it deals with procedures for voting for emergency responders and other emergency personnel. California takes sort of two approaches to this. The first is looking at out-of-state emergency workers. If a governor declares an out-of-state emergency, then those emergency workers that are sent to another state to respond to the emergency may vote by receiving their absentee ballot by either mail or fax, like military and overseas voters do. One of the other things about all of these emergency response professionals statutes is there's every state has a different approach to what is an emergency responder. And in California, their approach is to allow the governor in his or her writ to define who would qualify for this procedure.
And, Ms. Strother, I just might add, I know that in 2012 we had this arise in Minnesota because there were Minnesotans who went to the East Coast on an emergency surprise basis, I guess you might say, to help with Hurricane Sandy. There were certain utility workers, I think, and others who, and I heard from some of them after the election, who on a moment's notice were told that they were shipped out to New York and New Jersey.
And I think Tammy Patrick, who will be presenting now after me, will cover that too, because a lot of these states that implemented these emergency procedures for first responders did that after 2012, after seeing that they had a bunch of voters who wanted to cast a ballot, but because they were leaving the state on a last-minute notice and didn't necessarily have an address where you could send a ballot to, or the mail on the East Coast was greatly disrupted, even if they had an address, it wouldn't reliably get to them, that they needed alternative procedures to ensure that those folks who are going out to respond to an emergency are able to cast a ballot. California also has a procedure for in-state emergency workers, which is a little bit unique. If the governor declares an in-state emergency, an in-state emergency worker is then allowed to cast a ballot at any polling place. California has provisional balloting, so I reached out to the California Secretary of State's office to get some clarification on this, but it sounds like it's treated like a provisional ballot, but they are still able to cast their ballot even if they're not in their home precinct. And again, who qualifies as an emergency worker is defined by the executive order. Other states have similar approaches. Louisiana allows an emergency worker to cast a ballot or to receive their ballot by fax or email if there's a declared emergency. Maine does the same. They allow them to use the UACAPA, which is the military and overseas voting procedures, and that again allows them to receive a ballot by email. Again, they'd have to return it, though, by paper. Mississippi allows emergency workers to receive, again, a ballot by email or fax, but Mississippi has a pretty narrow definition of what counts as an emergency worker. They must be trained or certified workers, and so that would limit the number of folks, arguably, who would qualify. New Hampshire, interestingly, has procedures for providing ballots to first responders, but it doesn't explicitly allow the transmission by email or by fax, but instead says that law enforcement may transport the ballots, and I don't think, as far as I can tell, that has ever been done, but that is what Gary's giving me a funny look. New Jersey statute says that law enforcement may transmit the ballot, and so I presume that that would involve an emergency, you know, outside the state but close to the state. And then Oklahoma doesn't specify how ballots can be transmitted, but does give the Secretary of State authority to come up with alternative procedures. And then next, there are a few states that give procedures that apply or special procedures that apply to all voters and are designed to ease voting in the case of an emergency, not just for those emergency first responders, but all voters. Alabama's law deals specifically with absentee voters. And in an emergency, if it's declared by the governor and a governor of another state, allows those voters who are qualified to vote by absentee ballot to use special rules that are promulgated by the Secretary of State that allow them to vote. And it doesn't specify what those rules would be, but one would assume, again, that it would be something like alternative ballot transmission. This is another issue that we saw in Minnesota in 2012, where we had regular absentee voters who are, you know, going to school on the East Coast or there for business and had requested an absentee ballot, but because of the issue with the mail service, weren't able to receive the absentee ballot. Another state has a similar approach. Utah allows the lieutenant governor, and the lieutenant governor in Utah is the chief election official, so they are like the Secretary of State, to designate other methods for casting a ballot. Again, it doesn't specifically list what those methods could be, but presumably, again, the most common alternative is alternative transmissions for transmitting an absentee ballot.
Ms. Rother, as to the Utah model, do you know whether there's an emergency rulemaking requirement, or is it just more or less an order of some sort by that office?
Yeah, no, the only state that specifically talked about promulgating rules was Alabama. Utah essentially gives the lieutenant governor the authority to designate alternative procedures. Though notably, if you look, the emergency must be declared by the governor of Utah, the president, or the chief election officer of a political subdivision. So this could
chief
be...
Chief executive officer.
Yes.
Right.
Sorry.
Okay.
Of a political subdivision. So this could be a county that has an emergency. But again, the lieutenant governor would get to decide whether or not alternative voting procedures are appropriate. Remedy for that emergency. Washington is a state that votes entirely by mail, so every registered voter in the state receives a ballot in the mail, and that is how they vote. But they have a procedure that could be used in the case of an emergency or an issue with mail delivery, but also could be used generally. There's no emergency requirement, but if you don't receive your ballot or you lose your ballot, you are able to go online and download a PDF of your paper ballot and then vote that and mail it back in. And then finally, the last category of emergency sort of procedures or powers that we've seen in other states is the ability to extend polling place hours. Most states, there are procedures to extend polling place hours, but they usually require the intervention of a court, and that is how it is in Minnesota. You can extend polling place hours, but it requires a court order. South Dakota allows a county auditor to make the decision to extend polling place hours if there is an emergency, but polling place hours, the extension is limited to the extent of the emergency, and once the emergency situation has been resolved, they can extend it beyond that.
So is there any caveat for the duration? I mean, if the emergency extends for 2 to 3 weeks, is that okay in South Dakota, or is it an 8-hour? Or does it just not say?
The legislature, the statute doesn't say. I would presume that if they had decided to extend it for days, that someone would then involve the courts and argue that it's unreasonable. But it says that the hours are extended until the emergency situation has been resolved. South Dakota is one of the states, though, that allows an election to be postponed, under certain circumstances. And so one would assume that if there was an emergency that lasted weeks, that the state would get involved in a postponement situation. But I don't know if they've ever encountered this. The example that's most frequently used, and I think it was cited in the Wisconsin report from last time, was, you know, the University of Wisconsin-Madison had a bomb threat in one of their polling locations on Election Day. And so in that case, folks weren't able to access the poll for several hours. And so do you extend the hours to accommodate, you know, the backup of voters because of that bomb threat? So those are the state laws and the general sort of categories of state laws, but I'd be happy to answer any questions, I think, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Okay. Any questions or comments? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that one of the things, especially in looking at some of these other states, the challenge for us is that every state has a little bit different election law. So if you only look at these things in isolation and don't consider the context, you don't quite get the total picture of the impact or even why they do certain things. So just thought I'd mention that, so in case, because when you get this, you're just looking at it in a very narrow way. And but it's like even Minnesota's election law, in context, it makes more sense than just taking one piece of it.
I think that's a very fair point. Ms. Strother?
Yeah, and that's true because every state has very different election systems. There were some states that I didn't include that had emergency procedures that would, for example, allow people to vote an absentee ballot without an excuse. I didn't include those because we have no excuse absentee here, and you don't need an emergency in order to be able to use that tool. But other states have different approaches, and there's what this presentation doesn't give you an idea of is other states that have a little bit also more flexibility in state law that would allow them to do some of the things that I think we can't do. For example, moving the polling place, I think there are states that allow, that have less restrictions on moving a polling place. You know, our state has a pretty narrow window when you can move a polling place and where you can move it to, and other states, I think, don't. And so it's only in the case where you have a narrow sort of, you know, you can move it here, that you might need emergency procedures to move it, you know, outside of the precinct or consolidate them. So,
any other questions or comments? And we can always come back to this as well. But thank you, Mr. Other. Yes. Oh, Representative Nelson.
As I'm thinking here, questioning, and you talked about Alabama, that says the Secretary of State may promulgate rules. How long ago was their law passed, and have they, do they have rules on that they've gone through the rulemaking procedure to do that? Or,
you know, I am not certain if they have gone through like a formal rulemaking procedure to promulgate sort of a standard set of rules. But my understanding from the Alabama law is that it would, that they could essentially do expedited or emergency rulemaking to sort of deal with the situation as it presents itself. I didn't see in their regulations anything about sort of general emergency procedures that they've promulgated since this. But I think the intent of the law was to give them sort of emergency expedited authority to create rules. But I haven't seen them promulgate anything from it.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary of State. The other question I guess I had that came to my mind as we're going through this, you talked about emergency workers, and every state defines it differently. And there was, you said in Sandy or 2012, Hurricane Sandy, we had a bunch of workers that got sent out. I'm thinking line workers for the electric company would be one. Mm-hmm. Are those considered emergency workers? Because there's other, one of the other states talked about special training and certification and whatnot. And, you know, would those be considered emergency workers? And is that what we were talking about in Minnesota?
I think it depends on the state. Some states, their definition is pretty broad, and it's essentially anyone who is dispatched to work to respond to an emergency. And so those would be, you know, both, you know, electrical utility workers, you know, the EMTs, we had, I think, in Minnesota, you know, we had utility workers go out. We had, you know, local fire departments sent folks out. But there's also other states include things like if you're volunteering for the Red Cross, then you could be considered an emergency worker. Some are very specific, some are broad, and I think that if that was something the task force was interested in looking at, the definition of who would fall into that category, I think, is important, because some states are very specific. You sort of have to be an emergency, certified emergency worker, and other states leave it more broad for people who, depending on the situation, may get called in to respond to the emergency but aren't traditionally an emergency worker.
Comments or questions? Senator Kiffmeyer?
Well, I think that it's just the very nature. You really only know the extent of an emergency in hindsight. Mm-hmm. And the problem is when you're trying to look forward to what might be, I think an emergency worker could be so varied because it could be snowplow people in something. It could be flooding. It could be. And so every one of them, the tornado, the whatever, has its own thing. And so I think we had looked at that before of having a broad framework more than narrowing it down into exactly what it was. But I think that's why when I saw it, some of these that in the governor's executive order in the ones that did it, they gave who the emergency workers were. Because at that time, you would have at least a little bit of a sense. The problem is who have you left out? Mm-hmm. And especially in elections, that equal treatment issue can then be cause for a lawsuit after the election based upon that. So it's a very challenging area. You just kind of really hope for things to go really nice on election days because it's unlike any other regular emergency. But I think that's why the when I looked on that, that would probably do it. But I think it, even then, because when you're in the middle of an emergency and the very chaos that usually comes with it, it's really hard to get a handle on all that that means. So I think it's a very challenging task that we have here.
Yeah. I thought it was surprising to see that there was a state that got that specific, to say it had to be only someone who was certified as a, say, an EMT or something like that. That just sort of surprised me. I didn't know any state had done that for the reason that you're mentioning. Any other comments or questions? Okay. With that, hopefully with a minimal awkwardness, we will call Ms. Patrick. Hi, Tammy. This is Steve Simon. I'm calling you. You're on speaker in front of our emergency planning task force. Can you hear us okay? Hi. Let me just introduce you quickly. I didn't want to do so until we got you on the line. For the members of the task force here, Tammy Patrick is a senior advisor at the Democracy Project with the Bipartisan Policy Center, focusing on discussion on recommendations of the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. She's with us today to give us an overview of contingency planning resources and strategies. So, Ms. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us. And I'll let you know if people are having trouble hearing you. I don't think that'll be the case, though. But I'll stop you if
there's anything. Wonderful.
But go ahead. Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much. So thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, both to the Secretary as well as to the task force members. Just a brief background in addition to the work I'm doing now. I was a local administrator in Maricopa County in Arizona for a little more than a decade. And Maricopa County is the greater Phoenix metropolitan area. We had about 2 million registered voters. And much of what I'm going to draw on today, you'll see there's quite a bit of it that comes from our work in Arizona. It was after my work there, during my time there, that I was appointed to the President's Commission on Election Administration. And so you'll also see how that weaves its way through the presentation itself. So my apologies for not being there in person. I wish I could. I'm actually from Minnesota myself and have much family in the Twin Cities area. So I'm not sure how you want to go ahead and walk through the presentation, if you have it projected or if you just have paper copies. But
We have both.
You have both. Okay, yep. So what I think I'll do, if it's all right, and I know there are quite a few slides, but as it needs to transition to the next slide, if it's all right if I just say next or next please, I think we'll go ahead and get started, if that's all right.
Great.
Excellent. Great. Thank you. So we can move to the first slide. And really an overview of what I wanted to share with you today is part of a presentation that I presented in New Jersey at their state association meeting recently. And it kind of goes through a case study of what happened in after Hurricane Sandy on the East Coast, covers some contingency and recovery plan strategies that, various jurisdictions have used, and then also talk about the use of technology in election-related disaster recovery and contingency plans. A lot of what you'll see here probably raises more questions than, provides answers to. And so along that line, starting off the very first slide, there is one thing that I think is really critical when thinking about election contingency plans, and that is the distinction between what type of an election it is. What we saw in Sandy, of course, had to do with a federal election that was going to go on no matter what happened in one state or in one region. But there are many times where there can be something that occurs in a more isolated level, either a state or local election. And will your plan need to address those types of distinctions? And so next, we all know that a regular, quote-unquote, regular election cycle is full of all sorts of logistics, planning, and very, very precise execution next. But in certain instances, we have things that occur, such as we saw in Hurricane Sandy, where the best laid plans are thrown out the window, and it's good to be able to turn to a predetermined set of protocols on, what to happen should that occur. So if you go to the next slide, please. The next two slides that you're going to see are part of a presentation I gave to our community network back in Maricopa County during this whole process of what was happening in Sandy to share with them kind of what was happening. So we know that as the storm was approaching the East Coast, voters realized this was going to be hitting right around Election Day. Election administrators were scrambling to kind of keep up with the flow of early voting, which they had early voting available. And, of course, across the country when we talk about early voting, in some cases it's no excuse absentee. Some refer to early voting that the ballot is actually being tabulated right there as it's being cast in a, pre-election day environment. But in any case, we're discussing the opportunity for voters to react before election day. And I know that in Minnesota you've recently had legislation passed in the last year or so that has kind of expanded the opportunity for voters, and that really can be very critical in a contingency type of a situation so that voters can react before Election Day if they see these sorts of things coming. The thing that really complicated efforts in Sandy had to do with a lot of the infrastructure was completely gone. So let's go to the next slide. In leading up to Election Day, I was watching colleagues from across the country kind of look to the East Coast, and there were election administrators who were literally living in their offices and warehouses, one, because they wanted to watch for possible water leakage, make sure that ballots and equipment were still going to be available. They needed to answer and respond to the public inquiries. And quite frankly, many of them were afraid that if they left their office, they wouldn't be able to get back to the office again, given the, structure of the roads and whether or not people could actually get on mass transit, that sort of thing. So next slide. In fact, one official in Maryland was posting that, and this is kind of a play on the the conflicts that we have in elections between paper and electronic voting equipment. She wasn't sure if she should sleep and protect the paper ballots or the electronic voting machines, but instead she opted to just sleep on the floor of her office. Next. So Election Day came around, and there were still a lot of polling locations that were without power. And so when I think about elections and contingency plans, there are kind of two ways of looking at it. You've got your infrastructure, and then you also have the specifics that, tie directly into election administration. So next. But one thing that really complicated matters that we actually saw impacts in Arizona was that because of the scope and the scale of how large Hurricane Sandy was and that it was multi-state, there were first responders coming from all over the country to backfill in Ohio and Pennsylvania for first responders from those states that had gone to New York, and some of the coastal regions, including West Virginia, where they got hit with that big snowstorm. So it wasn't the case that our laws allowed for these individuals to be able to come in at the last minute a day or two before the election, because it was after an early voting period in Arizona, because the emergency was not within our state boundaries. So next slide, please. So we really thought that was a problem. And with all of the implementations from the MOVE Act, which allows for military and overseas voters to receive their ballots and balloting materials electronically, we now, all states have the ability to service this type of population. And so really articulated that a comprehensive plan to review options within the state for voters who are assisting outside of the state and whether or not statutory and or rules allow for that. Next, please. Felt so strongly about this that it did make its way into the Presidential Commission on Election Administration report because the president established the commission right after the 2012 election, where we did see the long lines. Hurricane Sandy and that impact was very much in the forefront. It was contingency plans were part of the president's executive order. Next, please. So we think that this could really happen in a couple of ways by either modifying existing laws such as UOCAVA's or the Help America Vote Act, or changing language in state statutes to expand to cover populations and protections for first responders. And some states have, in fact, provided that protection. So next, please. There are some other possible and potential legislative considerations that cropped up in Sandy that New Jersey and New York and other states have had to go back and revisit, and that is whether or not there's even the authority to consolidate polling places into what some might consider vote centers. And then in addition to that, how are the ballots going to be processed if they're considered out of precinct? Is there some sort of a legal allowance for that? What portion of the ballot counts? How will that be taxed? Will it be counted at the jurisdiction where it was actually placed in the ballot box, or will that vote be actually tabulated and considered cast back in the home jurisdiction where the voter is registered to vote? So there are all sorts of complications to servicing voters in this way that some states are far in advance and have figured this all out. Other states are still trying to iron out some of these wrinkles in their plans. Next, please. Another legislative consideration is in some states they have a requirement that schools be available for polling places, and some actually have election day as a school in service day so that the teachers are the only ones present, or they're out of the building for workshops and professional improvement days, because that removes students from the school itself and kind of addresses those security concerns that we've seen after many of the unfortunate school shootings that we've seen across the country, provides lots of parking for voters. But in the contingency world, it also allows for the use, if you are doing consolidations, to use some of these larger rooms like gyms and cafeterias. Should you come into a situation where you need to consolidate precincts and polling locations into central locations, having high schools and gymnasiums and elementary schools, that sort of thing, allows you to have access to that. So next, please. This, I just have to include the picture as the header for the leading into the recovery plan. This was down in the subways at Times Square. And, of course, no one ever envisioned, how are voters going to get to the polls when the subway is completely flooded. Next, please. So I think comprehensive plans consider both the infrastructure, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of basic utilities which serve the community as a whole, but then also very specific administrative processes with both the state and local roles and responsibilities. I know in Minnesota you're very, very, very sensitive to making sure there's uniformity in process and understanding, and any state that's undergone a recall understands the importance of all of this. So I wanted to kind of talk about that a little bit, and then also some of the resources that are available to maybe guide you in some of this decision-making. So next, please. Last year, the Secretaries of State, the National Association of Secretaries of State, or NASS, did publish a report, and I'm not sure if you've reviewed this or not, so I just wanted to highlight a couple of main points as I saw them in the report itself. So next, please. The contingency plan report goes through, and this is all taken verbatim. It does talk about some of that infrastructure and some of the things to consider when it comes to coordination with law enforcement, fire medical services, that sort of thing. Next, please. And then also ways to think about informing voters, news media challenges, some of the contingency plans, and we'll talk a little bit more about paper ballots versus some of the touch screen and the pros and cons of both of those, as well as precinct paper rosters and electronic poll books. Next, please. So one of the things that's mentioned, and this is actually a photograph from Los Angeles County's warehouse, which is, of course, huge because they are the largest jurisdiction that conducts elections at the local level, and they have, I would say, probably about 100 generators in their warehouse that they have, and that's something to really consider in terms of knowing what kind of wattage it takes to run all the polling place equipment, having ulterior facilities and alternatives already set up so that you know where polling places can move to and what sort of electricity, what sort of needs are actually there and available at those types of facilities. In the Secretary of State's program, they also talk about evacuation procedures for bomb threats, fires, and other emergencies. So they do get into some very specific mitigations and specific ways to think about different types of emergencies that could occur. Next, please. They also talked about making sure that you have some guidelines in place for managing poll worker shortages. So a lot of times we think about there being some sort of a disaster or a snowstorm or something, and many times jurisdictions fail to consider, well, wait, we're not going to have our poll workers are not going to be able to get to the office, or our own staff may not be able to get to the office. What are our backup plans for that, as well as securing the voting machines and equipment in an emergency situation? So next, please. And then there's also a discussion about cooperation amongst neighbors is key. So I think about this in terms of if there's a blizzard that were to come through the Midwest, and I grew up in Minnesota, I know these things can happen and can be devastating, and it can be a wide swath that affects not only Minnesota, but it may also affect Wisconsin and Iowa and the Dakotas. So having some sort of a pre-established communication line with other states, but then even within the state, knowing that there's a certain protocol that can be put in place so that the jurisdictions conducting the elections have a central number to call, and even having predetermined when an event hits. In New Jersey, one of the things that they did is they established a daily call at, let's say, 2 o'clock. I don't remember exactly what time it was, but they established a predetermined time every day where they opened up the phone lines and all of the election administrators could call in and listen and hear about what was going on. And that really, really helped to make sure that there were open communication lines and that the message was consistent and correct and everyone kind of was really on the same page. So next, please. One piece that I thought was very important in the NAST report has to do with some of the FEMA offerings of online emergency management training courses, and it lists a long list of all of the different things that that they have available as a free resource. So many of the states are thinking about incorporating this into some of their training and certification programs that they may do at the state level for their locals to make sure that they're all kind of on the same page. Next, please. And then one other resource is the Congressional Research Service Report, which talks about some of the ways in which legislatures have dealt with emergency situations occurring in an election cycle. The only downside to this is that it was published in 2004, but the National Conference of State Legislatures does have additional information available on their website. Next, please. And then one final big resource is the Election Assistance Commission, which offers a full chapter in their election management guidelines, as well as what they call a quick start guide on contingency and disaster planning. This was, as you can see on the screen, it was published in 2007, and they're in the process of updating all of them with additional information. But a lot of this is still very, very relevant. Next, please. And then in that document, they also list a whole wealth of other resources that are available. And then the next slide. One of the things that the EAC chose to do was to lay out contingencies and change factors very specific to the type of issue that was occurring. So whether there was a fire, whether it was a blizzard, poll workers that didn't show up, and then provide some change factors related to a very specific event. Next page, please. So there's, I was just recently in Harris County, Texas, and Harris County had a very good example of reacting to a major catastrophe in 2010. Their warehouse burned to the ground. Next slide, please. So fire consumed their warehouse 51 days before early voting was scheduled to start, and it was a complete and total loss, about $43 million. They lost everything. They were a jurisdiction that printed their poll books in-house, so that equipment was all gone, all of their voting equipment, everything was lost. They still conducted their election 51 days later. They received almost 30% of the voting equipment was brought in from other Texas counties. And I'd like to highlight this because I think it's important to know what resources you have within your state and how there's a potential possibility to redistribute them if one area has a more dramatic impact than perhaps another portion of the state. And then the balance of their voting equipment came from the vendor themselves. Next slide, please. One of the things that they learned is in their new warehouse, they now store half of their voting equipment behind a firewall. And I don't necessarily advocate that everyone have, you know, a firewall put in or that sort of thing. However, I think what this does demonstrate is that having redundancies in the system and taking what resources you already have and protecting them and maybe having them in two different sites, that sort of thing, can be one way of at least ensuring that you have something available moving forward in an event that should possibly occur. Next slide, please. So what I wanted to share with you also is that when we were thinking about putting together a disaster recovery plan in Maricopa County, we started thinking about it, and for me, it didn't really seem that it was made any difference whatsoever whether it was a fire or a flood or an explosion that destroyed the warehouse. To me, it was just, if the warehouse is gone, what are we going to do? And I also was very much of the belief that when events occur, it's almost important in planning and the reaction as where something might occur. So we took those two elements in creating our county plan. So if you go to the next slide, please. So this is a screenshot from the index of the recovery plan. And we did a chronological order of events, and we really started thinking about in an election cycle, we might have candidate filings, that sort of thing that happened, you know, 120, 105 days out. But really, if we broke things out to 90 days out from an election, 30 days before an election, a week before the election, the weekend before an election, election day, and then post-election, that would give us a good understanding of how we would react differently should an event occur. And in our county, we have three main offices. We have, which is listed here as McTech, and that was our tabulation center and warehouse where all of the voting equipment and our early voting, the tabulation, everything occurred there. Downtown is an administrative office, and our Mesa office is also an administrative office that both downtown and Mesa were used for early voting locations. So we looked at it from kind of two different ways of, you know, when something happens and then also what if it only impacts one of our facilities. Next slide, please. So even though we coordinated in this way, we realized that a disaster could affect maybe a single polling place, multiple polling places. What if our print vendor, because we do a vast majority of our, I keep saying our, I haven't been there for a year, but habits are hard to die. So the print vendor helped us with all of our early voting and vote by mail. And in Maricopa County, 65% of the voters were on a permanent early voting list. So the vast majority of the voters who were voting by mail. So what would happen if our print vendor had issues, or our satellite voting locations, or our post ID, our hand count facility, the receiving sites where we get everything on election night. So we took those into consideration as we went through the chronology of our plan itself. So next slide, please. So one of the things that we did was consider what materials were present at each stage of the election, because that's what we felt really would trigger our response to whatever the event happened to be. So a warehouse catastrophe that happens a month before the election is very different from the day before, because a month before, you still have all of the voting equipment. A day before the election, in Arizona anyway, the election equipment has already been delivered to the polling places, and the warehouse was virtually empty. So we felt that it was important to kind of make those distinctions. So what we then did is we turned it over to each of the department managers to say, think about how it would affect your division if this were to happen at this time. Next slide, please. So this is a sample of one of the pages of the report. If a disaster happened at our tabulation center, and this particular screenshot, I believe, was taken at 90 days out, so what would happen in the tabulation room, which is our BTC? How would it affect early voting? And then each manager was responsible for going in and making their own notes of if something happened and you wanted to make sure you had some guidance, what would you put in this section to help inform your decisions when you're probably concerned about your own family and home and that sort of thing? Next slide, please. And then in the book, we also included templates for a voter notification mailer that would go out if the post office was still around and delivering a notification to our city and town clerks, because many of them are on the county's ballot in Arizona, a candidate notification to make sure that everyone who's on the ballot would have an understanding of what was happening, the other types of districts like school districts, a press release, a website posting script, the call center scripting for calls that might be coming in, some alternative facility listings for training, and then relocation schemas. So if we needed, if one of our offices was down and we had to shift that work to one of the other offices, how many desks would we have available, that sort of thing, and then some vendor contact information, employee contacts, that sort of thing. Next slide, please. And we also made sure that in each of our facilities, each of the three buildings, there was a small suitcase that had evacuation kind of stuff in it, so first aid kits, the copy of the disaster recovery plan, bottled water, flashlights, those sorts of emergency items. Next slide, please. So then when it comes to tools and technology, we can go to the slide after that. Out on the Presidential Commission has a website. It's supportthevoter.gov. And we provided a toolkit that allows for election administrators, go to the next slide, please, to go in and do some resource allocation kind of studies. So next slide. Given just some basic information, if you knew that you were going to have to consolidate polling places or precincts, voting precincts, and move them into a school gymnasium, being able to look and see how many expected voters you were anticipating having, how many check-in stations you might have, how many voting stations, whether that's, an actual voting booth for a paper ballot or a DRE, a direct recording piece of equipment, you could put this information in and then get information back that tells you how long the person would have to wait, voters would have to wait in line to check in, how long they would have to wait to vote. Next slide. So here, this kind of just details kind of what I just mentioned. You can do this for any election. It's not just for contingency plans, but sometimes in a contingency situation, you don't have the benefit of being able to draw off of historical data of how many voters turn up in a certain place at a given time. So this allows for a little bit more of that leeway. Next slide, please. So there's an example that's provided, given how many estimated voters, some of the information that you can input into the system. Next slide. And it shows you that a change in process of just 30 seconds can take something from a 7-minute wait on the top of the screen where it says it takes 90 seconds, you have two check-in stations, it's only a 7-minute wait. But if there's something that adds 30 seconds to that process, now the voters have an hour-long wait. But if you increase the number of check-ins by just one, you drop that back down to a 3-minute wait. So this is the wait in terms, which is the yellow that's being reflected to actually check in. And then the next slide is the amount of time to wait, which is the pink, in actually casting a ballot. And so you can see the dramatic difference between 8 voting stations or booths and 11, or allowing voters to sit at the cafeteria tables to mark their paper ballot, that sort of thing. Next slide. So just wanted to kind of summarize by talking a little bit about the use of technology. So one of the pieces of technology that the Presidential Commission recommended strongly was the use of electronic poll books. And some of the pros to them is that they're far more adaptable and easily updated in a changing environment. If polling locations are modified, they can accommodate more voters because an electronic poll book can offer the expansive roles either of an entire county or jurisdiction. And in some cases, they can also actually have the entire state, depending on the number of voters that you have and the type of poll book being used. They aren't reliant upon a print vendor who could potentially be impacted as well. Next slide, we'll talk about the disadvantages. Of course, there's a reliance upon electricity, which can be very problematic. And additionally, there, in many cases, the way that they're set up is there needs to be a connectivity to an operational voter registration system, either at the state or local level, to upload or download the information, depending on how it's set up. Next slide, please. Early voting, or the opportunity to cast a ballot prior to Election Day, by, as I mentioned before, by offering voters expanded voting opportunities, either at alternative sites, it accommodates a moving population, so if one portion of the city or state is affected, voters are still able to cast a ballot at another location, so it allows for that moving. Next slide, please. But there are, of course, cons, because if you're relying on the post office, they too can be impacted. There are additional connectivity challenges. And then even just the transportation of supplies, materials can be problematic if, you know, there's transportation impacts as well on roads and that sort of thing. Then the next slide. On new voting technologies, there are some real benefits. Some of the newer voting systems allow for ballot marking on a voter's personal device, which allows for distribution away from that central location and relieves some of the pressure at the polling place with the lines by providing all of the ballot marking devices at the polling place. Instead, a voter has that available on their own system, and then they just come in and are able to cast the ballot without taking the time to mark it, which can take, depending on the size of your ballot, quite a while in the polls itself. It also allows for the voter-specific ballot delivery so that you don't have to worry about ballot styles because they're all being sent electronically, and you don't have to worry about the actual creation of the ballot and having them available for voters as they come in. So it's far more nimble than the traditional system. Every state already has a system in place to provide military and overseas voters with a ballot electronically after the MOVE Act. So there are ways that we can perhaps leverage the existing infrastructure to service populations in an emergency situation. Next slide. But again, there are cons. So voters may also be impacted by the lack of electricity and internet services. Most statutes don't currently allow for ballots to be returned this way. So you would still need some sort of traditional polling location for the casting of the ballot. And this was one of the issues that they had in New Jersey during Sandy that made a lot of headlines. There are also security concerns. By several states have allowed UOCAVA voters to return ballots electronically for years. And Alaska also allows all voters to do this if they so choose. So next slide, please. We're almost done. And then, of course, there's online voter registration. Arizona was the first state to implement online voter registration, and I have been an advocate for it for over 10 years. It really enables the impacted population the ability to update where they are, to get information. You can look at it in terms, depending on your laws for privacy and collection of email, which can be a challenge from one state to the next on how and when or if that can even be done. But some states have used that as a way of collecting email addresses to push out information to voters, whether it's about polling place, times of the polls are open, contingency information, poll worker information, whatever it happens to be. But many of them have in fact, said that it's not a public information available to candidates. And then there's a reduction of office time spent keying as well that helps provide staff time to react to the triggering event. Sorry about that. My phone was buzzing, and I wanted to make sure you all still there, and I wasn't just talking to my desk. So then, of course, the other problem is that it all relies on the electrical grid, and the pictures that you see here are pictures in New York and New Jersey where people who had electricity provided it to anyone walking by. They just put power strips out so that individuals could charge their phones and their computers, that sort of thing. So there was still some infrastructure there, but it's certainly something to consider. And then the last slide has all my contact information, and I would be more than happy to talk about any of these individual items or discuss anything further if there were any questions.
Thank you very much. This is Steve Simon. I really appreciate that. That was a great presentation. That image of the scuba diver in the New York subway is going to stick with me for quite some time. I haven't seen that. I'd never seen that photo. So I have a couple just lead-off questions for you based on your Maricopa County experience and the document that you were showing us pieces of. Was the making of that plan compelled or mandated either by the legislature or by your county government, or is that something that your office decided just to do as a matter of good practice after Hurricane Sandy?
So we actually did it prior to Hurricane Sandy. We did it, oh my goodness, I think it must have been back in about 2005 or 2006. And I can't remember the exact reason why we started. I think it was I was at an election center event or one of these national conferences and had heard someone talking about a contingency plan, and I thought, oh, we don't have anything like that. That's a problem. And so we started just kind of from scratch thinking about how should we organize this, what's going to help us as the local administrator. So there was no outside impetus to it at all, but we organized it in a way that for us really seemed to make the most sense. And it does leave out whole considerations that we felt would be part of them being addressed by the state, part of them being addressed by the rest of the county government when it comes to pieces of infrastructure. So although in the report we talk a little bit about making sure you have liaisons and are talking to law enforcement and some of these other divisions, for us it was really all about how do we react in an election situation. We saw what happened at Katrina and in Louisiana. How would we respond? The other interesting kind of thing that I think probably influenced us to do it the way that we did is it was in Arizona. It was in Phoenix. I think it would have been a completely different thing if we'd been up in northern Arizona where they get snow. But in Arizona, it's sunny every day. Seriously. So we were thinking, well, what sort
don't
of...
Don't rub it in, please.
I know. I don't live there anymore. But so it was one of those things where, like, well, we don't have considerations of snowstorms or of hurricanes. Now they get the monsoons, but monsoons traditionally happened in early July and were usually done by the beginning of August, and the primary there is in August, but now that's actually the weather there is changing, and they just had a devastating monsoon last week. And so I think that's why we were predisposed to not say, let's think about it in terms of reacting to a fire, reacting to a flood. The one thing that we did think of was, well, if, the dams break, we're going to be underwater. So it was really, I think, part of the main reason why we didn't think about it in those terms. Whereas, being in Minnesota, what's going to potentially impact you the most is going to be some sort of a snowstorm. Florida, of course, has a very rigorous contingency plan as well at the state level because they've had numerous hurricanes affect large portions of the state. Louisiana also has a very rigorous program and plan that can be drawn upon.
So it sounds like this wasn't compelled by, a legislature or by your county board. It was something that you just were proactive about. Let me ask a question about legislative activity on the opposite end, not before but after, or during, I should say. Was there anything you encountered as you were putting together this report or this plan that required legislative action, where you thought, we want to do X, but we can't do X unless we get a law change or we get something like that? Do you remember?
There really wasn't, because Arizona had had online voter registration since 2002. We'd allowed for no-excuse voting for a very long time, either in person, no-excuse vote by mail. There were a lot of contingency-type programs that we were able to take advantage of, but thinking about them in terms of contingency situation. So one thing that I did have occur, and that was, I believe that you participate in Pew's VIP, the Voter Information Project, and that was something that the state of Arizona has yet to get on board with, but Maricopa County joined a few years ago because we really saw that as something that would be of huge benefit in a contingency situation, and that's what happened in New Jersey on Election Day. The state's website went down, and the state elections director was able to get a hold of the VIP manager. They've been a member for a while, and really have that kick into high gear so that people knew that they could be redirected and still get the information that they needed. Even though the state's official website was down, they were still getting official information. So that's something that this state, they wouldn't need legislative will to their legislative ability to do that. They just need political will.
Okay. Any comments, questions from other members? Mr. Poser.
Hi, Tammy. Gary Poser. So I'm just curious if when you made your plan, was there anything that you needed from the state, like the Secretary of State's office itself? So, you know, you're looking at your contingency and saying, this is a piece I really need something from the state to give me, you know, like the access to the voter registration system or anything like that.
And it's good to hear Gary's voice. Full disclosure, I've known Gary for a very long time, and I always I've learned much from him over the years, so I'm very happy that he's present today as well. We didn't necessarily have much that we considered in terms of the interaction with the state, and the reason being is the way that the infrastructure of the Arizona system is set up. Maricopa County and Pima County, the two largest counties, have their own voter registration system. And so when the state, and we did not have a statewide voter registration system prior to HAVA. So when HAVA and the statewide system came about, the two largest counties just started feeding into the statewide system that serviced all the rest of the state. So we didn't need that as a backup necessarily. What we did have, though, and firmly established, was with the city of Phoenix, which is the largest jurisdiction in Maricopa County, and they use the same voting equipment. So we have them established as the backup for any sort of tabulation, as well as a backup for should there be a need for any of the polling place election, you know, or voting equipment. And so there wasn't this, because we didn't see this as being a statewide plan, we didn't do that. Now, if I were to go back and do this again, I think that, and I've presented our plan to the other counties in Arizona, but I don't know that anyone else has established a contingency plan and or what their format is. And I also don't know necessarily that the state has a formal plan in place. So we decided to just kind of forge ahead. If I was doing it from a state level, I would think that it would be helpful to maybe lay out a template or some sort of a guideline of what you would want the localities to be considering, how they would fulfill certain obligations or certain responsibilities, and then have them provide that information that could be kind of a composite to see if there's consistency and or identify areas where additional maybe procedures or rules or legislation may be necessary.
This is Steve Simon again. I have a question. It's the age-old tension between uniformity and local decision-making. And there's sometimes, and in this case, I think sometimes in tension. Before you were on the call, Senator Kiffmeyer, who, as you know, was our former Secretary of State, said quite rightly that you've got to look at the context, and the different states are different. I suppose the same is so with counties. So on the one hand, I don't want to put words in her mouth. She can speak for herself. She's here. But uniformity is a good thing. On the other hand, what's good for Hennepin County and Minneapolis isn't necessarily the right thing for Lake of the Woods County. Do you have an opinion that you care to share about where to strike that balance between uniformity on the one hand, which can look like one size fits all on the other?
Right, absolutely. And I agree. And this is something that the Presidential Commission heard a lot going around the county, around the country. As a local election administrator from one of the largest counties in the country, I understand that wholeheartedly. What we found, though, is that there are certain administrative processes that are being done by everybody. And so that's more what I mean about uniformity. So it's not necessarily that everyone is doing exactly the same thing in exactly the same way, but that the general, everyone's registering voters, everyone's putting them on the voter rolls, everyone's laying out a ballot and providing a ballot. The ballot language and the way that a candidate's being presented should be uniform across the whole state. And so I'm thinking about uniformity more in those terms of there being similar procedures and processes that are done in a very similar way all across the state, that sort of uniformity. Because if you get into too much deviation has that root of deviance. That doesn't sound quite right, but if you get into too many deviations, then that can certainly be a big problem. And I agree wholeheartedly that, we were accused of being the great state of Maricopa, traveling around the country. Every state has a jurisdiction that is the largest jurisdiction. The size of that jurisdiction, we just convened some large jurisdictions for the Bipartisan Policy Center recently, and some states, the largest jurisdiction, their largest county was 300,000 people. And then we also had L.A. County that has 4 million registered voters, almost 5 million registered voters. But they all had some very similar concerns and challenges being the largest. And one of the things that we found in Arizona is that Maricopa would maybe come up with something like this plan, and we would then share it with the smaller jurisdictions so that they could adopt and adapt to their needs, but yet an overall structure was still being maintained.
So let me just try this on for size. Are you saying that you more or less favor uniformity among the categories that should be considered, but that local jurisdictions should be in charge, for lack of a better phrase, about how to implement them? For example, someone might say, okay, every county or every jurisdiction should have a plan for how to evacuate people, how to communicate with voters, how to deal with personnel shortages, whether they're in the county office or election judges, but that Lake of the Woods County should decide how to accomplish those goals. The goals should be uniform, but the execution of those goals should be particularized. Am I getting what you're saying?
I think that's fair, and I would take it even maybe one step further to say if and when that were to happen, so one, making sure that everybody has some sort of plan that they're considering. So here's a little bit of an example. Last year, in 2014, the state of Colorado implemented their new plan, their new kind of format where every voter is mailed a ballot, and then they have vote centers, and they have early voting, and they have election day registration, and any voter in a county can come in because it's all tied to the statewide voter registration database in live time. They had problems with that connectivity throughout election day all across the state. So I talked to local officials, and we did a review to try and identify why this occurred and other things. And I talked to some counties, and they said, we had contingency plans in place, we had backup paper rosters, we had backup terminals in case it was a computer issue, we had this and this and this and this and this already laid out. And I had other people say they decided they were just going to make it up. They didn't think why would there be any problems? They'd never had any problems. They didn't have any backup. They said, we just made it up as we went. So I think you want to make sure that people aren't making it up as they go along. And then once you identify that everyone has a plan, gathering those plans together and looking at them to say, okay, these are some of the best practices of what the various counties are doing. You can even, in Colorado, they call them tiered counties, so tiers 1, 2, and 3 based on population. And so you can still address all of the same issues and concerns, but also taking into consideration the variation that the counties and the jurisdictions have to deal with in terms of distance voters travel, the resources they have available to them, connectivity to online resources when you talk about rural areas. So I think you can still get to an end game where you have some consistency, and you can also highlight some things that other people may want to consider.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments? Senator Kiffmeyer.
I think you had one too, Grace.
Oh. Go ahead.
Well, on that subject, thank you. Thank you, Tammy. This is Senator Mary Kiffmeyer. On that subject, when we passed, was around for the Havilah, and the biggest battle on the federal level was they wanted to tell us exactly what equipment. Of course, we'd have to pay for it. But they would tell us and dictate to us many, many things. And so what we really worked for there, because the pressure was so strong to just do something, was to set standards rather than dictate exactly how. And when I think of emergency planning, and I was just writing down as we were going through this just some examples, like say you have to move your precinct or something like that, a standard could be closest possible to the original location, easy access and handicap accessible, good parking. You know, those would be the criteria, which I think the reasonable due diligence that we have to do in an emergency in that context, it helps whether you're a large county or a small county. I think you can, you're going to have to make those judgments, because even within a small county, for individual precincts, you have, say you have War Road, and then you have the unorganized territories, which are a lot of them up in that county. Very different situation, very different governance structure. But if the standard are set as close as possible to the original location and some of those criteria, I think within that, I think we got some smart people on these county and city folks like that who can figure that out quite nicely. And I think it saves us a lot of the other issues. I think the one thing, Tammy, I think of is I was appreciating the question about what were things that kept you from doing that? And I think of, Julie, you shared the one law that it has to be within a mile or within the same precinct. Well, mm-hmm. in an emergency situation, I think you'd want to be able to have a little more maybe flexibility, but only in that emergency declared situation. I think that would be one example where I think of that. So would that be, Tammy, could you just share comment on what I've said and if that fit into your Maricopa plan as well?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that those are incredibly relevant and pertinent points, because for a variety of reasons. One is that if you do impose a restriction of miles, so a lot of times, so we were, just for a little bit of background, we were under the Voting Rights Act under Section 5, and I did all of the Department of Justice submissions. So when a polling place would move, we would have to explain why, and I'd provide the documentation. And the Department of Justice always kind of wanted it to be within 5 miles. That was kind of the general rule. Being in our rural areas, that was fine. But when we got out onto the reservations or out into the more rural areas, 5 miles is still someone's farm. You know, so you're absolutely right in that when you give a very rigid kind of rule or guideline even, that can be very hard to be successful in attaining that. Your urban areas may be able to do that, but the rural areas would perhaps find that more of a challenge. The other conflict there is, of course, if you have an area that is dramatically impacted, it could include that short distance. So Hurricane Sandy, that was, you know, the vast majority of the East Coast, so you weren't going to find something a mile away or 5 miles away. They were maybe 20 miles away. But the population had also shifted 20 miles away. So I think that those are incredibly relevant points. And I think that you're right that local officials will know best in their area, and you just want to be able to give them guidance and the tools to be successful and not, you know, handcuff them or shackle them to a rigid rule. And part of that also plays into, you know, some states have that a polling place has to be located in a government building, or it has to be located in a school or a county building. It can get very, very, very prescriptive. So the more that you allow for some flexibility, I think the better off you are, particularly in an emergency situation.
I have one other question that was asked of me to ask of you, and that was from one of the folks here that are here today. And that question was the cost of using the e-poll books. So do you use the e-poll books in Maricopa, or have you had experience with e-poll books? And then add to that maybe a comment on the cost.
Sure. So the e-poll books, the county migrated to them while I was actually sitting on the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. So I recused myself from that entire process because we were talking about e-poll books at the national level, and I didn't want there to be any, any question about our dealings with the vendors and finding out about various technologies, that sort of thing. So the county did move to them and implemented them very successfully. Part of the challenge, and I also know that right now the state of Ohio, which is one of your kind of close neighbors, is in the process of securing e-poll books. I believe that they were at the state level doing a matching fund program. And if I'm not mistaken, I probably shouldn't throw out numbers unless I'm 100% positive, but I believe at the state level that it was something like $12 million that they have allocated, and then providing that as grants to the localities, and if they needed to augment that, they were able to do so. But the thing that,
Steve, I think the figure, I just happened to cross this, that the state of Ohio in one-time appropriation, it was an 85-15 match. So they paid for 85%, the state of Ohio did, for e-poll books. That was
great. What we did at the county level is that we were still printing everything on paper. And for Arizona, as I mentioned before, so many people were voting by mail anyway, that we had such few voters showing up at the polling place, and we were yet printing up rosters and registers and spending an awful lot of money on that. Which it seemed that, if I remember correctly, when we were going through with the cost savings, we would eventually hit a point where we broke even within, I think it was, two federal election cycles. So within 4 years, and from that point on, it would have been a cost savings. The additional thing that we hadn't taken, not just in the cost of printing the registers and rosters, the other consideration there is that one of the benefits to e-poll books, and when I know you're expanding sort of the pre-election day opportunities to vote, you want to make sure that information is updated and current at the polls on Tuesday. So that was one of the reasons why we had so many provisional ballots in Arizona. So in the 2012 presidential election, we had 122,000 provisional ballots just in Maricopa County alone, of which something like 79,000 were voters that we'd sent the ballot to that hadn't voted it. So we needed to have them vote a provisional ballot, which now with electronic poll books, we would be able to tell the voter hadn't returned their ballot, and they'd be able to vote a regular standard ballot, not a provisional. We spent almost $600,000 on provisional ballot processing for that election alone. So there are a lot of additional benefits and cost savings that can feed into electronic poll books that you may not even realize until, after they've been put into play.
Okay. Ms. Wachlerowitz?
Tammy, this is Grace Wachlerowitz, and I just have a question on your contingency planning. If we could go back to that. I'm not familiar with the county on how the elections are administered relative to the local jurisdictions, whether the county does it all or the involvement of the local. So I was just curious how you engage the local jurisdictions, how they deploy these contingency plans, because I'm assuming they were part of the poll workers, et cetera. So how did that flow work, or wasn't it applicable?
Sure. It's nice to see you, Sigrid. In Arizona, the counties actually go into contract with the municipalities in the various districts to conduct the elections for them, with the exception of the city of Phoenix and the city of Tucson, and they conduct their own elections, but they do not coincide with state or federal elections. So their mayoral races occur in the odd-numbered years. And then what we would do, because in Arizona there are four consolidated election dates, so all elections have to occur on those four dates. So if there was a region that was maybe having a school district election and it overlapped into the city of Phoenix, then we would coordinate with the city clerk's office to make sure that we were in the same polling place, but voters would have to go to one table to get their school district election ballot and to another table to get the city's ballot. And one of the ways that we communicated with our city and town clerks is that every month we had a community network meeting, and all of the clerks were invited, and we would, and that's part of what this presentation was part of. We would address one particular item each year or each month and keep them apprised of what was happening. And then we had one staff person at the county who was the liaison directly to them and to all of the districts, to keep them in the loop. And in our emergency plan, they were definitely considered in terms of, because the metropolitan area is so spread out, being a western city, that if one part of the valley was impacted, it would be quite likely that we could direct people to other city halls and town clerk's offices to help us. And they all agreed, and we worked with the League of Cities and Towns as well, to make sure that everyone was kind of on board in this sort of a backup contingency situation. And we included in our emergency plan, like, the template that would go out to all of the city cities, both the clerks and then also to the districts who were having an election at that time, so that they would be apprised of what was happening.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Gary.
So, Tammy, you actually brought up something that I hadn't considered as far as emergency planning before, but when you mentioned the requiring special elections or all elections to be held on certain consolidated election dates, I guess I'm wondering if that's a good thing, because you can marshal all of your resources for an emergency on any of just those particular days, and you know you might need your resources on that day, versus is it better to have special elections spread out throughout the election and throughout the year, and you just might only have a few smaller issues to deal with for an election. So I'm just also in my mind, I wasn't sure if I should be pro-consolidated elections or if I should be thinking that we should keep it the way we have it.
I think you're on the same track as a lot of people, and myself included. So they had four election consolidation dates, and all specials, recalls, everything had to happen within those four dates. But there were certain considerations based on the size of the city, if it had to be in the even or odd-numbered years. And the same goes, and that was something that was just passed by the legislature a couple of years ago, and it was challenged in court because home rule cities and towns challenged whether or not the state had the ability to tell them when to conduct their elections, as far as odd or even numbered years, and the municipalities won. So the city of Phoenix and Tucson, they hold their elections still on those four consolidated dates, but they're able to do it in the odd numbered years and not compete with the federal races in the even numbered years. All of the other municipalities, however, now have their elections on in the even numbered years. I've done some studies on that. I'd be happy to send it to you. I testified in Kansas. They had this was brought forth a bill. And part of the challenge is whether or not those elections are partisan or nonpartisan, and whether or not they do runoffs or they have primaries, and how that's treated by what ballot is being provided to the voter. So in Arizona, for the jurisdictions that were of a certain population outside of Tucson and Phoenix, they were on our even-numbered ballots for years and years. The way that we made that
kind of palatable for those jurisdictions is that districts that were on a consolidated ballot got a much better rate because the real estate of the ballot was being divided up among more jurisdictions and districts. So it was actually less expensive for them, and they did see higher numbers of voters voting in some of those down-ticket races. But you do have the fall-off in some situations, but they actually did see more voters voting, but less of a percent of their population, if that makes sense, when you look at some of the actual turnout rates. So there are different reasons why people consolidate their days. I think that the days themselves, having four election dates, even with four election dates in Arizona, people still didn't seem to know. We still saw a pretty paltry turnout in the spring election cycles, and that was traditionally the municipalities and the school districts, and then the fall was the state and federal races. So when this consolidation occurred, we now see very few races in the spring, and they're almost all in the fall in both the odd and the even-numbered years. So, for instance, they'll have an election coming up in November, and all the school districts will be having an election. It's almost an entirely county-wide election in Maricopa County, even though there's no county-wide office or proposition or question on the ballot, but by virtue of all the school districts having an election on the same day, almost everyone will have an election on that day.
Yeah, I was just kind of going in more of, you know, when you were doing your plan and you were saying, you know, from 90 days out from the election, this was your plan, and 30 days out from your election, this was your plan. I think that's a little bit easier if you've got consolidated dates when everybody in the state is holding elections on the same date, where, you know, we could have some school districts in our state doing special elections one week, and the next week different schools are having their elections, and we can be on different cycles where with some of them were right within the 30 days, other ones were within the 90 days. And I'm just thinking about how difficult it is to try and plan for all of those elections
right
on different dates, and whether or not it would be something to consider whether we should be thinking about consolidated dates, I guess, is where I was heading.
Right, and even if you have consolidated dates, that's the beauty of establishing, and in Arizona we had four, so it was March, May, August, and November. So even if you have a triggering event for a special election where you have a vacancy for whatever reason, you have some sort of a bond question that needs to come up, if you have the consolidated dates set up in such a way that there will be another election coming up in 60 days or in, you know, 90 days, it allows for that jurisdiction to still be able to put the question or put the election out to its voting population in a pretty timely manner. And also then voters can kind of tune in that, these are the four election dates, and I may have a school district election, or I may have a jurisdictional election, or, you know, it's only going to happen in another part of the county or another part of the state. By having those four consolidated dates, it doesn't ensure that every one of those days you'll have an election. So then if you did have an emergency that occurred, say it was a March snowstorm, which I know would never happen in Minnesota, but if it were, then it might be the case that you have, 40% of your population having an election and is impacted, and the others don't, and you can shift some of those resources potentially from other parts of the state or from other jurisdictions to assist.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments at this point? Well, Ms. Patrick, thank you very much. I will just say that we have here, we made a few. It's pretty heavy here. You can see a color version of the... I assume it's online, too. Ms. Strother, is it online?
I think we'll have it online. It's not online yet.
Okay. It will be online through the LCC. You'll be able to get it online as well. We made a few. We didn't make one for everyone, but we have a few. If someone wants to see the paper copy of Maricopa County's actual report, you'll see here it's pretty pretty thick. So I want to thank
before,
you.
Okay, if I could just say real quickly, before I'll send a redacted version, because I know people's phone numbers and stuff are on there, so I'll send a redacted version for posting online, if that's all right.
That's perfect.
Go ahead. That's great. I think that's good.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time and for educating us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So in our remaining time, what I thought we would do and what's on your agenda is to start the discussion, not end it, but start it. So I don't think we'll arrive at any decisions, particularly because there's some people not here today that I think will be want to be part of the overall discussion. So this will be a beginning. And you'll see that in your packets, two pages, which we thought might be helpful to guide the discussion. And the way that we saw, at least, the menu of options or the way to tackle the problem, one sheet just is about emergency plan development, which we just heard a lot about. And the second has to do with emergency election procedures. They seem to be distinct. So emergency plan development is different. That's things like I had mentioned before, the laundry list of kind of emergency preparedness items that I know many of you are experts in terms of personnel, in terms of power being down, in terms of evacuation, in terms of communicating with the public in times of an emergency, those kinds of things. So one set of questions for us to come up with by the end of this process in our report is, what do we think should be done about that? And there's some options there I'll go into just in a second. The second page, is emergency election procedures, meaning if everyone has a plan, regardless of who authors it and what the scope is, about all the items I just mentioned, what, if any, are election procedures we might consider because of an emergency? And then the question, of course, is always bound up with who decides. So this is just the way that we, as we were conceiving of it, thought to tackle the problem. And on both of these sheets, you'll see sort of menu options, for lack of a better word. They aren't an endorsement by those of us who added to the sheet. They were meant to be a broad list of menu options, some of which we might dismiss out of hand immediately, some of which we might embrace. And I'm sure there are some that we just didn't think of, but we meant to be as broad as possible and suggesting, you know, what's a possible menu here? So I thought it might be good to start out with the first page, the first discussion, because we're fresh from a discussion on a lot of those details, and we may not get in our remaining time at all to a discussion on the second. And again, I want to emphasize, I don't think the idea here is to make a decision as a body, but to get the conversation started about emergency plan development. And as you'll see, the options, and there may be more, again, that we didn't think of. You know, one would be that this task force would just make a recommendation, no kind of mandate or suggested legislation, but basically the report would say, you know, we as a task force recommend that the Office of Secretary of State and local jurisdictions create an emergency plan, and we may even say with the following considerations in mind. You know, the plan should include such matters as how to evacuate people, communicate with people, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one option. Another option would be having legislation along those same lines. No specific requirements, but that one of our recommendations would be that the legislature require Secretary of State's office and local officials to do this. No specific requirements, but just you've got to have one. The third would be, again, legislation that would say you got to have one, and here are the broad things that it has to include. And the fourth one would be legislation that's far more specific and maybe do as I believe Connecticut did and a number of other states, saying in essence that there's a model default plan. Counties or local jurisdictions are free to do their own, and if so, that becomes the plan. But if they choose not to or don't have the resources to do one, then the model default, presumably Secretary of State, but I guess state plan would be it. And maybe as part of this, you know, it could even include rulemaking. I mean, that would be the most prescriptive. And if you recall in your packet one or two meetings ago, I keep in my mind the example of Connecticut seemed to be the most highly prescriptive. They got really in the weeds, in my judgment anyway, by rulemaking about what their local municipalities must do or must not do. Real granular detail from my standpoint. So that's at least a menu option. And then the questions below are meant to sort of stimulate the discussion, which is if there's a plan under any of these examples, but I suppose mostly 2, 3, 4 above those plan development options, you know, does someone screen them to make sure they're adequate? If so, who is that? Is it the Secretary of State? Is the governor? Is it someone else? Or maybe there shouldn't be any screening or filtering or blessing, I guess, of the plans. Should every local jurisdiction be included? Should it go to the city or, in some cases, town level? Or just should we use as our building blocks counties? or should there be a hybrid in the case of, say, Minneapolis with Hennepin County, as there was apparently in Maricopa County, where Phoenix is sort of on its own? And should the requirements be different? Third, should the Office of Secretary of State plan, if there is such a plan, be part of any official rulemaking process, or should it just be a plan that our office would be empowered to make, whether it's binding or non-binding, or should it be done through rulemaking? The advantage of rulemaking is there's a lot of public process and input. The disadvantage can be that it can be very prescriptive and it has the force of law, and we may not want to do that. And then finally, obviously, what is a reasonable timeline with respect to the 2016 election? As some of you on this table know better than others, we have a short session coming up and a late session coming up. So the question is, if any of this requires or should have legislative action, is it practical or reasonable to expect that it will be in place in time for the 2016 election? These are some of the questions on this score. So I'm interested in people's thoughts. That's a lot. We won't even get to the second sheet, probably. Maybe we will. Let's see. But I'm interested in your initial thoughts, if there are any right away. I have some, but I don't want to hog the microphone. Any initial thoughts about approaches? We're not taking a vote. Nothing's binding here. You can change your mind next meeting. It's just any initial thoughts or impulses. Well, I'll tell you my initial thought. And I sort of keying on Senator Kiffmeyer's comments about uniformity, but everyone is different. And I think we're all trying to find that sweet spot between something that guarantees Minnesotans, generally speaking, equal, not only equal access, but rules that are more or less the same, maybe not precisely and always the same, but more or less, so that if you live in Kitson County or if you live in, Watonwan County, you're basically going to be treated the same, versus something that's so uniform and so prescriptive that it's really a one-size-fits-all, this works everywhere, every time, in every circumstance. And maybe I'm stating the obvious here, but I think finding that sweet spot to me is really important. The one that seems to me to come closest to that, but I'm open to other arguments, and that's why we're having this discussion, but without having heard from any of the rest of you, the one that seems to make the most sense is something along the lines of number three, which would say some legislation that says there's got to be a plan, but the plans should include roughly these categories, but we're not going to get more detail than that. We're not going to tell you what your plan should be, ought to be. It's not the same for Lake of the Woods as it is for Hennepin or Ramsey, and maybe include specific requirements, like the plan must address evacuation. It must address power outages. It must address communicating with voters. It must address that sort of thing. And some of you are experts in this in other non-election contexts. So that seems to make sense to me. The devil is certainly in the details. And as Senator Kiffmeyer alluded to, we might not catch everything. But something like that, at least off the bat to me, makes sense in terms of not being command and control from St. Paul and telling Kitson County how to run everything up there and how to communicate with which newspapers and which sources of public information are the best, but yet saying, well, Kitson County, you ought to have some plan that touches on this area. That's what feels right to me off the bat, but I'm open-minded about it and I'm interested in other people's expertise and thoughts, and particularly those of you who are involved in emergency management in other fields, not just elections. You might now or at a future meeting, we don't have that many more, but want to tell us what you think generally, not as to elections, but generally is the right balance and what has worked in your experience, whether it's elections related or related to something else. So I'll throw that out there as something that makes sense to me. I'm, in terms of these other questions below, I don't know about this issue of filing with our office or some sort of approval. My first reaction is that's not necessary. I'd like to think that, let's say counties, if we use that as a building block, are responsible enough and professional enough that they're going to do plans that work for them and that others will let them know and can let them know through non-legal means if their plan is deficient. Someone can say, hey, you didn't consider this or you didn't consider that, rather than some mandatory pre-approval or review process. that's what feels right to me in terms of our office's role, but I'm interested in other perspectives. Are there others who want to chime in? And this won't be the last time we revisit these issues, so. Andrew Cox?
Just a question, first of all. Is the Office of the Secretary of State an independent institution or part of the executive branch? Is it subject to executive order, governor's executive orders?
That's interesting. We are subject to certain executive orders, but on the emergency preparedness executive order, including the recent one, the legal interpretation of our office, and as I understand it, the governor's office, and Ms. Rother, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that probably not. So the continuity of government and continuity operations executive order that came out recently, sort of piggybacking on the one that came out a couple years ago, our office sort of falls in the cracks there. We're not subject to it formally and explicitly.
I'd put that that's somewhat unfortunate because that's definitely a basis for a plan. My recommendation would be that the Office of the Secretary of State has a plan similar to this based upon federal and state guidelines. It can certainly be independent of the Office of the Governor if that's what's determined. What that doesn't do is have any type of authority over counties and cities and separate jurisdictions and so on and so forth. And so that would your office personally, I would think, would be part of that planning process, but certainly couldn't compel anyone else to do so. As far as giving templates or guidelines, I think that would be a good place to start for such templates and guidelines, and that leads me towards leaning towards recommendation one, or recommendation only. But as far as the legislative process and rulemaking is certainly far beyond my understanding or capability.
Yeah, and Major, I think you're right that we ought to, even if we're not, if we're in the cracks and we're not subject to the governor's executive order, it's good for our office, we ought to have a plan in place. But as you acknowledged, because of the way our election system works, it's really at the other units of government where the election, the rubber meets the road, where they're doing the real work, certainly on election day, of running the elections. And so that wouldn't be binding on them, but maybe some sort of template. But I think the important thing to me is that they... that there be some plan in place that they themselves have a hand in. I 2 weeks ago, I was in Lake of the Woods County. I use it as, it's a fresh example for me. That's why I'm using it. They have 17 precincts. So in my former legislative district, I had almost that many. So in the entire county of Lake of the Woods, there are 17. 15 of them are mail only. Only two precincts have actual polling places. One of them is Madette, the county seat. And so their plan is going to look very different than Ramsey County, obviously, because... they're all male, except for two. So I think that tension always exists there. Can I say, ask you, Major, in your experience, in your observation, in other contexts, which I know you've had, what do you think the right balance is between, on the one hand, uniformity is a good thing. On the other hand, different parts of our state are different, and what works in Ramsey might not work in Lake of the Woods. That's a broad, sweeping question, but do you have any opinion based on your experience?
It is, but I think the, was it Tammy that just spoke? Mm-hmm. I think her point that they all have certain functions that have to be determined, and those functions are in common, and how they get to the end state is up to the individual county or up to the jurisdiction. In the military, we talk about commander's intent, where you have, you know, the boss gives an overall scheme. This is the end state that I want. The ways and means are up to the subordinates to get there within certain guidelines. And I think corralling the herd of cats that is local, state, county government, they're not going to take well to being dictated to by the state. They're certainly not going to be in some cases, will intentionally not follow rules that are mandated from higher. But giving just best practices or giving good ideas or giving, hey, here are the functions as we see them, and ensuring that you have a plan in place. And by the way, here's examples of plans, and here are our ideas that have worked at the federal level, that have worked at the state level, that may or may not be applicable to a subordinate or smaller jurisdiction.
And do you have an opinion, Major, about whether it's a good idea for, let's say, counties, every county to have a plan. It could be their plan, but that they have one.
Yeah, I really don't, to be honest with you.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. When I looked this over, before you even said number three, I tended to think that that seemed to be a good place that I would support. I'm thinking about the importance of having plans so that, as we've discussed, there's some measure of uniformity. So, for instance, and I think it gets tricky in the details, obviously, but if there's a power outage, say, without running elections as well as others do here, I would think that it would be great to have a plan in place so that there's the first opportunity is to try to restore the power, that you're finding a generator or some other way to keep the polling place working and intact. And then if that fails and there's some need where you absolutely have, you know, I'm sure there's different procedures to run through, but then if you absolutely have to move the polling place, that should be the last resort, I would think, because of the disruption to voters. And, you know, in between, I don't know, like, if the polling place could be the hours could be extended longer if there was a power outage for a set number of hours or something. But I think that it's pretty important that there's some type of plan. And I'm not stuck on the details here. I don't know what those are. But so that if there is something like a power outage, at our first, and I'm sure this would be the election officials' first instinct, is to try to restore the power or have procedures in place so that voters are impacted as little as possible. I think that I'm sure that counties, and I'd be interested to hear from locals, some counties already do have some of these plans in place, but I think it is good then to have some sort of broader mandate required by the state that they're considering certain things. So, for example, a communication plan, or what happens if there's a power outage. Again, how they deal with it, I'm a little more ambivalent for, keeping in mind that we want there to be some semblance of some uniformity so that voters are relatively treated the same throughout the state. But I do think that as we look at, you know, people want their government to function well, and they want to know when they go to vote that they're going to be treated equally. And certainly people, Minnesotans, understand that emergencies can occur. But I think Minnesotans in general would want us to know that we're talking about this and we have some sort of plan. So regardless of whether they live in Candy, Ohio, or Washington County, they'll be treated relatively the same with a top priority of making sure that their access to the polls is in every single circumstance is protected as much as it can be.
And go ahead, Ms. Walker-Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to repeat everything. I agree with everyone. So I'll just limit it to comments that haven't been brought up. And I would imagine from the township's perspective as well as from the city's perspective, we have a lot of models throughout the state. Some counties do more than others. Some delegate quite a bit of the responsibility to the local jurisdictions. So I just respectfully say be careful on what level you restrict the contingency planning. It has to go all the way down to the local jurisdictions. So that they're involved, they get the information, and in many respects, they are the ones that are actually administering the elections in the field. So I just respectfully want to note that it has to go further than the county.
So let me just clarify. So, for example, we have a lot of elections jurisdictions, mm-hmm. if you count all cities and towns.
Right.
So preliminarily, won't hold you to it, you could change next meeting, but is your first instinct that the county is a pretty good unit to work with in most cases? I think Minneapolis and St. Paul might be exceptions, maybe Duluth and St. Louis County. But overall, as a building block. The counties, as long as they are factoring in communications with local governments, do you think, in other words, let's say we did settle on something like number three, is 87 plans enough, 87 counties, or should there be hundreds, many hundreds of plans required by each jurisdiction? Or is it enough that the counties include and work with the local jurisdictions on their plan?
I think it'd be reasonable to have 87 plans, to have the point person as the county. But I'm just respectfully saying, don't say the county makes the contingency planning.
Got it.
That it has to be in collaboration, working very closely with the local jurisdictions. That's critical. We need to have that communication flow. We're the ones that are boots on the ground, not the county, in a lot of respects. There's a lot of different models. So I just don't want us to be forgotten in that respect.
That's important. I think Representative Nelson was next.
And Mr. Secretary, this is what I first going to talk about, but as we were talking here about the counties, what about school districts that cross county lines? I'm thinking of Anoka-Hennepin school district that, right, I think now that's the largest school district in the state that's in two counties. The two counties have separate, vastly different plans. Which one are they going to abide by if they have an issue during their election? I mean, so we got to, I think you're right. I think we need to have it go down plans for different levels. And I think this has been talked about by some of the presenters. Different elections have different contingencies and different things they have to deal with. So, you know, we have a school district election is different than a city election or a township election, and have different problems come up and different availability of resources. But what I was going to say at the beginning was, when I raised my hand, was number three sounds more right to me, and maybe that's because we're legislators and you're a past legislator and looking at what it might be, have to be some laws changed to do that. And as far as reviewing and approving plans, I don't think that should be done by the Secretary of State's office, but I think they should be filed. You know, Boy River Township in northern Minnesota has a plan, it should be filed with the Secretary of State so that there's somebody as the chief election officer of the state. If there's a problem up in Boy River in an election, somebody has a copy of that plan at the state level that could say, okay, are you following your plan or are you making up as you go along? I mean, that's something. I'm not approving it, but they should be filing it someplace so it's a centralized record for it.
That's a great distinction to make. And also, I'm glad you brought up school districts. Editorial comment is that we put our school districts in the state sometime in a little bit of an awkward position. Not all states do this because we ask them to run elections, and they're not in the business of running elections. That's for you legislators to decide someday. I don't have a seat at that table anymore, but it can be awkward because we ask them to do that, and that's not their business. And so that complicates things even more. So I think we'll have to revisit that topic, particularly where they cross county boundaries. So Anoka-Hennepin, whose plan applies? Anoka's? Hennepin's? That's a very fair question. Who is next? Go ahead. Ms. Nesbitt?
I did want to agree. It does need to go down to local. I know some counties do have the emergency plans in action. I know I was talking with our county auditor earlier this week. And as far as elections go, there's just the blip that maybe needs to be expanded on as far as election procedures. But as far as when it does need to stay local, because even something as simple as setting up another precinct, our county auditor doesn't have.
Right.
I don't mean that she doesn't know, but she doesn't see the area and understand, okay, this group's here, we've got this other group, this is why the precinct, we recommend a split here. The local people are going to understand their emergencies and what they've got to contend with. Because as far as quite a few of these emergencies, the election officials, we've dealt with them as, now not a natural disaster necessarily, depending on what you consider to be a natural disaster, but there's always election people who don't show up, machines always break down, something happens with the ballots. Those are just standard run-of-the-mill type emergencies we deal with on every election. And so, yeah, I agree. We definitely want to keep the local officials involved in this because they do know what's going on that way.
Gary? I
I agree with that. I think there needs to be plans. I think one of the ways we could address grace are you know, maybe the statute would say if you're a jurisdiction under a certain size that the county plan needs to address and work with the local officials under a certain size and incorporate them into the county plan. You know, a larger jurisdiction like Minneapolis, St. Paul would have their own plan as well that could address their own specific needs. But I don't know about requiring every single township to come up with a plan. I don't think is going to work very well.
I didn't mean that. Some of them would have 30 feet.
Right, right. But it always could be optional for any jurisdiction could always create a plan. But, you know, to require the smaller ones, I think, might not be the best way to go about it. And then as far as submitting them someplace, I personally would like to see maybe that they're required to post it on their website or something like that. I think then it is much more accessible to anybody to see what that plan is rather than it just being within the secretary's office. But I think, you know, if there was an emergency up in some county, you know, our logical thing would be then to go to that county's website and look for and see their plan, and we would know what their plan is without having to take up just the space of a paper copy being filed someplace in a file cabinet. I think it would be much more productive to see it out on a website someplace.
Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. I'll just quick address that. Unless you have a power outage and then the website does you no good.
That's right.
You don't have the electricity to read the plan. That's
Yes, that's right. That's right. And you start thinking that way and you really do kind of go down into what we'd said before. But I was going to mention that how many emergencies on a local level, and I know the Secretary of State office often gets those phone calls because they're informed or you get press calls or something. So many of those, on, and I think for you guys to know, you often don't know how many emergencies are taken care of that you just don't know about. That's good management because they took care of changing the location or whatever they did. And when I was also thinking of the I really appreciated the fact that you're getting the hang of this election stuff. I could just tell the difference after all these meetings that you're really a quick learner in that regard. But our general, if you might say, the command and control is actually the law. That is really the governing and is really important to when you do elections. And so when the local units of government or anybody else like that, that is their command and control that really has that really really important place and position that I know informs everything that you do in those situations that is similar to that situation. So that's really important. The other thing is, I don't know if some of the others here know, you have MACO, the Minnesota Association of County Officials. They get together, they compare notes, they have their own study sections and things like that that they work with each other that I thought it might be helpful that some of you might not otherwise know. And same thing with the townships as well. But I've experienced a couple. One was half. I was visiting a polling place as Secretary of State, and I just happened to be the very first one, and we came just a little bit early. It's always good because you've got a few to do. And over half the election judges did not show up. Oh. And it was, you know, how opening is like. It's just a lot going on right then. And so you just pitch in. And having been an election judge myself, my sister who was with me had also been an election judge. We said, the county's sending people. It's time. Okay, all hands on deck. And so I don't remember which spot I took, and another person took another spot. And we had a intern with us. We sent him out to put up the flag. And we just looked at the manual that the county had and followed the checklist and knew what things had to be done, and so we set to. And so for the first 15 minutes until the others came, the people came in to vote and had no clue that the Secretary of State was one of their election judges. And that's kind of the whole point, right? You're not really, if I could have had no spot, I would have, but, you know, you just got to pitch in and help out, and that's part of what you have to do. Another time we had a polling place that ran out of ballots. I went to see just because it had hit a big thing. And the most interesting thing is they not only had run out of ballots, it was just a very unusual time, and the whole thing converged on that one precinct. It was after redistricting, and there was a new apartment added, and it was just a flood of people coming. But when I happened to be there, one of the election judges, I said, well, how is everything else going? You know, just trying to help kind of with calmness. And she said, well, great, when the ballots get here, we're out of pencils, which we didn't even know. And so I handed a $20 bill to my assistant who was with me, and I said, go door knocking, go to the drugstore, go wherever you are, but go find 100 something to write with and bring it back. I assume they came. I don't know how it happened, but it all did. But that is just from that. But I know there are hundreds of other times. I think Mr. Poser, having been former Anoka County, I think you have a few stories you could tell. And many times the goal is to make it go so smoothly that there wasn't really necessarily, now when you ran out of ballots, there was no way you could do that. But somehow those pens and pencils showed up, and it doesn't matter because you just want to see to it that things go on. That's what's really important. But I appreciate, and I thought maybe it might be helpful to kind of tie those two things in on your thinking as far as elections and its unique kind of business. But I think as to the plan kind of thing, I get concerned about pure electronic storage of plans just because these are emergency plans, and so you don't know. But I don't know that they all have to. I think they have to be somewhere, but how do you keep them current? Emergencies like these are, you could have a really old, dusty plan that is worthless 10 years later.
Senator, that's a really good point, and we can get to later about whether there would be some requirement that they be revisited or revised or something every X number of years. I don't know what X is, and I defer to emergency management professionals about in this line of work what X should be. Is that 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? We are pretty much out of time. I want to be respectful of everyone's time. I thought Senator Kiffmeyer's comments were a great way to end, actually. She came out of retirement to be an election judge when she had to on a moment's notice, and that's the kind of thing that happens. It never rises to the level of Major Cox and others, as she pointed out. But next time, in addition to some presentation materials, I'd like to revisit this overall discussion. We don't have that many more meetings left, so that in a meeting or two, we can have something in writing that we can start sculpting or shaping a little bit together as a group and filling in blanks later. So I think these two pages hopefully will serve as a template for our discussion. We didn't even get to the second one, as I predicted, but thanks for your time, your attention, your patience, your commitment. Really appreciate it, and we'll see you at the next meeting.
One quick thing.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
We were going to have somebody locally here from Minnesota who'd actually gone through something like this. Is there anything on deck for that?
Person.
Right. Huh?
I've heard about them. I cannot find an actual person yet.
Barb Welty?
Debbie's helping me, and I'm just trying to get a hold of someone, and hopefully by the next meeting I can have somebody here. Okay. Unless someone else knows of an actual person who's done this, I can find lots of surrounding.
Well, we'll keep working on it. Thanks, everyone. The meeting is adjourned.